brothers and sisters in the Dharma. Good evening and a very warm welcome to all of you. We are very fortunate to have with us over the next 8 days the Venerable Achan Brahma Vanso, formerly known as Achan Brahm. I venture to say that many of us here who have had the pleasure to listen to Achan Brahm before will know Achan's Dharma talks are simple and easy to understand. It's unlikely any attendants will fall asleep because Achan tells many light-hearted and real-life Dharma stories, many of which are recent incidents in his widely traveled life. For those of you listening to Achan Brahm for the first time, I strongly recommend you to attend all of Achan's talks. I'm sure all of us, new and returning students, will find Achan's talks illuminating, inspiring, and a strong reminder of the humility of learning. In this regard, and before I go further, I believe the congregation owes a vote of thanks to Brother Ingjai, who initiated this recent visitation of Achan Brahm. A small commercial, if I may, on the Venerable Achan Brahm. Achan Brahm is an Englishman, 55 years old, a Cambridge University scholar, ordained in Thailand at the age of 23, studied Buddhism from the notable Venerable Achan Cha. In 1983, Achan Brahm established a forest monastery in Serpentine, outside of Perth, and is the spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. Without further ado, may I present to you the Venerable Achan Brahma Vanso. Thank you.
First of all, is the sound okay at the back? Can you hear me all right? Can you hear okay at the back? No, still not good. Is that any better? Okay, I'll keep close to the microphone, it'll be better. This evening's talk is in a series because these talks are both for the public and also for those who are attending a meditation retreat. So I'm going to be attempting to give these talks aimed at both the people who are here all day and also for those who are visiting. And the subject of this first talk is on meditation and the easy way to meditate. And as many of you will know, that the central part of Buddhism, how the Buddha himself became a Buddha, enlightened, was through the act of meditation. And meditation is not just something for monks and nuns. It is something which is spreading, especially in the Western world, becoming so popular that I'm having to train many, many other people, especially lay people, to help in the teaching of learning how to make your mind peaceful and quiet. So many people have problems with their lives, either health problems or marriage problems, problems with their children, and even problems with their business, simply because they don't know how to waken up their mind to create a sense of peace and clarity from where understanding and wisdom and harmony comes. I know that very often we complain about the state of our world and how many wars and conflicts there are and how much corruption one sometimes finds. But many of those problems, they can so easily be overcome if people would only waken their minds by developing a peaceful, calm, clear consciousness. And this is what meditation promises to do. It is not just for monks and nuns, it is for everybody, even for your kids as well. I recently read in the newspapers in Australia, and you may have also seen this in the newspapers here in KL, that a very prestigious public school in the UK, Wellington Public School, this year started what they call happiness classes for all their students. Basically, teaching every child in this prestigious public school in the UK how to meditate. Because this was a very conservative, traditional school, and because it was quite strange that such a school would initiate meditation, it hit the headlines in the newspapers, and many people asked the principal, the headmaster, "What are you doing that for?" And he said that he's seen the results already. The children not only learn quicker, that their academic performance goes up, but also they can learn to deal with the stresses in daily life which will face them in their future. It's very tough being a kid these days. It's tough being a parent too. Actually, it's tough being a monk. But one has to learn how to deal with those stresses of life, and even in English public schools they're realizing the meditation works. Even more fascinating, there is a professor at Harvard in the United States who for the last 6 or 7 years has been doing research on meditators. That's her speciality, that's her field. And what she has found is that anyone who meditates for long enough, their brain, their cortex gets thicker. In other words, you have more brain power. You increase your gigabytes. In other words, what you're doing is you're actually becoming more clever. You have more brain to work with. And in this age where there's so much competition, why not give your kids the competitive edge? Not just by getting them tutors in the evening, but getting them to learn meditation. Because it is a mental training. How many of you know, go to the gym, or at least plan to go to the gym next year for your New Year's resolutions? There is a huge amount of emphasis on becoming fit physically, because many countries realize how expensive it is to look after your health once you get sick, and preventative medicine is far more effective than actually fixing something up when it's broken. And because of that, many governments are encouraging people to get out, be fit, jog, play sport or whatever, because it's good for your health, it's good for society, it's good for economy. But even more than physical health, mental health is good for the economy. If you are peaceful and calm, you don't get so sick, you're more clever, more inventive. In every which way, you win. So, I think that someone here should gather all that information and present it to the government, and now we should have all these retreats subsidized by the government because they are good for your mental health and the economy of Malaysia. One of the monks in the United States told me this. He's been living there for many years, and many of you know that in the United States there is no public health cover. You have to get your own private health insurance. Otherwise, if you get sick, sometimes hospitals won't even admit you. So everyone has to have their health cover. And when you fill out the forms for your health cover, they'll ask you many questions, such as, you know, your gender, your age, and your past medical history. One of the questions you can answer is, do you meditate? And if you can answer yes, and get some teacher, such as a Buddhist monk, to sign the form, yes, you are a meditator, you get a hefty reduction in the amount of money you have to pay. You actually make money out of coming to places like this. Because everybody knows in the health industry that people who do meditate are healthier. They don't have so many problems physically or mentally, and they're more productive, and they cost the health system much less. That's why Wellington School encouraged meditation. Why in Australia meditation is encouraged. Why even in hospitals, in cancer wards, in modern hospitals, they also have alternative therapy as well, such as doing some meditation. Because meditation works. In my center in Australia, there are many people come to learn meditation, not because they're interested in Buddhism. They are referred by their doctors. They say you have a choice. You can take the medication, the chemicals, which have some side effects, or you can go around the corner to the Buddhist temple and learn some meditation. And you will find that the meditation lowers your blood pressure, makes you healthier, and also makes you happier as well. So meditation is also recommended for depression. Depression is a worldwide disease which seems to be getting more and more of a problem in many countries. And most times when people become depressed, they go to the doctor and they're prescribed medication. But again, most modern health jurisdictions realize that medication is only one angle to go. The other way is what's called cognitive therapy, where you change the way that you look at things, either by talking, by learning, but best of all is through meditation. For those of you who may have been at the Global Conference on Buddhism, the fourth Global Conference, which was held in Perth last June, the next one is going to be held here in KL, the last I heard, sometime in November next year. But the person who gave the opening speech was the former Premier of Western Australia. In Australia, each state has its own government which looks after things like health and many of the finances, the resources and whatever. The economy of Western Australia is the biggest economy in Australia simply because of the vast mineral wealth in the north of that state. And the Premier, the boss of the government, was a very powerful figure. And before, when we were planning the conference, we invited him to give the keynote speech and also to actually give a session on Buddhism and politics. His name was Dr. Jeff Gallup. A few months before the conference started, but after he'd accepted the invitation, he resigned because of depression. He made the decision because he was a close friend of the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair. They were at Oxford together. He was such a close friend of Prime Minister Blair that he was the best man at Tony Blair and Cherry's wedding. And so he was spending Christmas about 12 months ago at Chequers, the country house of the Prime Minister of England. And it was there he decided that he was suffering from clinical depression. And when he returned to Western Australia in early January this year, he resigned his position because of depression. After doing some strategies, he's now a professor at the University of Sydney. You know what strategies he used? He recently gave a talk in Sydney University and somebody sent me the transcript. Because now Professor Jeff Gallup mentioned in his talk I'm going to begin my talk by mentioning a good friend, Ajahn Brahm, and his talk, Opening the Door of My Heart. And he went on to quote many of those stories and to tell us all about the benefits of meditation, which he, as a prominent Australian, now he has a weekly column in the Australian newspaper, telling everybody just how meditation and what he called the philosophy of the East had helped him through one of the most difficult times of his life. Meditation works. You don't get depressed, you don't get upset, you don't get angry. Look, another story, there was a Sri Lankan man living in Perth. You know that most Sri Lankans are Buddhists, but most of them are what we call in Australia Waisak Buddhists, which means you only see them at the temple one day a year at Waisak, and they disappear for the other 12 months. So Waisak Buddhists. And so he was a Waisak Buddhist. He would turn up, show his face once a year for the holiest day, and then he would just go playing around the rest of the time. But he told me his conversion, if you like, to meditation happened because he was working in the Department of Minerals and Energy in Perth as a highly paid engineer in a very stressful job. And the most stress he had was from his boss. He had what we call these days a boss from hell. And I don't think I need to describe what a boss from hell is. Maybe you've got one. At least you have somebody who you can recognize if they had some more of those bad characteristics. It would be hell to live with them. These are the sorts of people who give you more work than anyone could ever do, who set targets which were only Superman could reach. And whenever you do that extra work, they never thank you, they just give you more, the slightest fault, they shout at you, they're demanding, they're angry, they never listen, they're bosses from hell. He had one of those. And it was terrible to work for this Australian man, who was always asking so much, never thanking him, even if he tried to do an extra piece of work. It's not good enough. Do more. Work harder. But this Waisak Buddhist noticed in the space of about 3 months, his boss changed. His whole character turned around. And instead of being someone who was so impossible to work with, someone who was always so angry and mean, he changed to being kind, sensitive, and he would say thank you. It was such a significant and sudden change that this Sri Lankan Waisak Buddhist couldn't help but asking his boss one day, "What have you been doing? Something in you has changed. If you don't mind me telling you, you were so difficult to work with earlier on this year, and now that you are a fine boss and I want to work even harder for you now, what have you been doing?" And the boss from hell said, "Well, it's amazing. I found this wonderful Buddhist temple close by and I go every Saturday to meditate there." "What temple is that?" said the Sri Lankan man. "He says Ajahn Brahm's temple." And the Sri Lankan, "That's my temple," he said, "that's my temple." He'd been going once a year just for Waisak, never realizing the treasure which was available in that place. And the wonderful teachings of Dharma, especially meditation, which he saw with his own eyes, changed a person's life completely around in 3 months. When he saw how powerful it was for himself, then he started coming every week too. This meditation is very, very strong. Because of that, it's great if each one of us learns a little meditation in our life. Don't ever think, "Oh, I am too busy. I don't have time to meditate. If you're that busy, you can't afford not to meditate in order to become more efficient in your work. In April next year, I will be going to London to give a talk at a conference. But this is not a Buddhist conference. I'll be giving a master class at the 2007 Human Resources and Development Conference for business leaders, for CEOs and vice presidents from around Europe. And the reason they've invited me is because even in business, in the boardroom, they realize that these techniques which you gain from meditation, of calming the mind, of becoming more alert, more sensitive, they actually work and they do increase the bottom line of your company. And that's why they're paying my ticket, putting me up in a hotel. And they're not religious. This is just to make more money. So, not only are you learning meditation and Buddhism here, for the next 8 days, this is Chempaka Buddhist Wealth Creation Lodge. It gives you a competitive edge by being more efficient. The meditation is a training of the mind. And isn't this what you have to use in your life even more so than your body? You have to be sharp. You have to be alert. You have to be able to make decisions and be correct. And how do you do that? Training your mind. Number two, you can go to these courses, which they even hold them here in KL throughout the world, usually in the 5-star hotels, where you hear talks just like this, or maybe not as good as this, and the only difference is the person who is giving the talk has hair instead of being bald, they wear a suit instead of a robe, and they charge you $5,000 just to get in the door. So this is a bargain coming here today. But what I'm trying to say is that the benefits of meditation are so great, and it's my privilege to be able to share them, to create a happier world with less depression, with less sickness, with more success, with greater ideas, to learn how to solve the many problems in our world. Even with religious harmony, there's one thing which all religions actually agree on, is the benefit of the peaceful mind. I don't know if you know this, but I taught a retreat, a meditation retreat, over the Easter period in Perth. One lady came for that retreat from Malaysia. She was a Muslim. She came in her hijab all the way from, I don't know what part of Malaysia. She came to our retreat center, which was a Catholic place we hired. She came there in her veil. When she came to the retreat, she took off her veil. She meditated for 9 days with us all. And at the end, before she left to go back to Malaysia, she told me, "Everything I heard here and learned here, I have no conflict with my religion of Islam. And in fact, I enjoy what I've read and heard and learned here so much, I'm going to share it with my friends, my Islamic friends, when I get home." It's a wonderful thing that the meditation can actually cross not just cultures, but cross religions as well. Because it just makes people peaceful, aware, alert, and also successful and happy. And everyone wants that. So having tried to sell my product this afternoon by telling the great benefits of meditation, how do you actually do this meditation? The meditation is very, very easy. once you get the idea. It's the idea, the very concept, which is the most important. Too often when people meditate, they try to meditate. They're always making it happen. But please remember that meditation is all about being peaceful and being still. And if you are still acting and doing things and controlling and wanting and all that, you're not peaceful anymore. To be peaceful, we have to just stop and just be. It's letting go or letting things be, allowing things to happen. I'll tell a story from my own life as a monk. After 5 years training with my master Ajahn Chah, like all the monks, we were invited to go wandering through the jungles, through the villages of Thailand, either going to other teachers to widen our knowledge and experience, or to find caves, jungles, quiet places where we could enjoy solitude and develop our meditation further. I've managed to find a very beautiful monastery up in the north of Thailand, which was abandoned. No one was living there, but it was so peaceful. For meditation, it was idyllic. The village was over a small hill, maybe 2 kilometers away, a very simple walk. And the villagers there were very happy to have a monk to feed, but they didn't really want to learn any Buddhism. At the time I thought, isn't that nice? I can just meditate and not be bothered by people asking me just one more question, Ajahn Brahm. That is my suffering as a monk. Now, sometimes I can't get away from people, they always ask me one more question. Recently I was returning from, I think, from the United States, and I was transiting in Changi Airport in Singapore, and many disciples in Singapore were actually inside the airport terminal to greet me, and they gave me something to drink. But all the time I hardly had time to drink my tea because they were asking so many questions. And I'd just come from a, I think, 17-hour plane journey from LA. I was tired. I wanted some peace and quiet. And my strategy was, I said, I'm going to go to the toilet. And I thought, that's at least one place I can get some peace and quiet. But I went into one of the toilet cubicles or the areas for the gents in Changi Airport. And those of you who've been to such airports know they have toilet attendants inside. And the toilet attendant saw me and said, "Oh, Ajahn Brahm, can I ask a question?" Even in the loo, people ask me questions. But actually, it was very nice because after talking with him, I wanted to go to the toilet as well, but I had to hold myself because I talked to him for about 1/4 hour. And in the end he said, "I'd like to give you a donation." And I said, "Look, I'm a monk, my tradition, we don't accept money." He said, "I will send it to you." So I wrote down my address on a piece of hand towel. And about a week later there was a letter in the post, $20 Singapore from the toilet attendant of Changi Airport. I thought, wasn't that a wonderful donation? I really loved that. Because he's obviously a very poor man, but he was really interested in Dhamma. But anyhow, that sometimes that you don't get much peace. But when I was in this monastery, it was idyllic because no one wanted to ask me any question. They just wanted to feed me. And so for 23 and a half hours every day, I was by myself. It was good food, peaceful, there were caves. It was in the high mountains. I'd only see a vehicle once a week. The car would come up to bring the mail and to take other produce back down the mountain. You'd have to be looking in the right direction to see the traffic. One car a week. In the first few weeks in that monastery, I was so happy. But after a while, my meditation started to become difficult. Now this is an important story for you all, especially those on this retreat. My mind started getting restless. I started having so many thoughts coming up through my mind. And I tried to stop those thoughts, like many people do when they meditate. But the thoughts got more and more strong. They became more and more crazy, until I started thinking what I call unmonkish thoughts. Thoughts about my old girlfriends, about romance, even about sex. And I didn't want to think those thoughts. I was a monk and I loved being a monk. But those thoughts kept on coming up into my mind. And the harder I tried to stop them, the more they came up. After 2 or 3 days, I was going crazy. And because I was on my own, I didn't have anybody to consult with. I couldn't go and ask another monk. It was too remote. The nearest monk was a long way away. And I didn't know what to do. And so one morning, I was so troubled by all these thoughts going on in my mind. I decided to go into the main hall, the main shrine hall. And I bowed before the big Buddha statue and I just said, "Help." And an idea came into my mind. The idea was this. Maybe it's because I was a Westerner. I said, "Let's do a deal." And the deal was this. For 23 hours every day, I'd ask my mind to be peaceful and watch the breath. But if my mind really wanted to think about old girlfriends, romance and sex, I said, "Okay, from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. every day you can think whatever you want. Anything goes." So I thought that was fair, that was reasonable. You can think whatever you want for 1 hour every day, and the rest of the time you behave. Having made that resolution, I went back to meditate. You know what happened? The thoughts were just as bad as they were before. Every time I tried to stop the thoughts, they'd come back again, sometimes even stronger. And by 3 p.m. I was just so tired and exhausted, trying to fight my mind. But I am an honest monk. If I promise something, I really try hard to keep it. So I went back up into my hut. I leant against the wall, put my feet up, because I was tired. And I said, "It's 3 p.m. now. Now you can think whatever you want. Anything goes. You can think sex, you can think girls, anything." And for the next hour, my mind was so peaceful, just watching every breath go in and every breath go out. It was a very strange experience, but what it taught me is the difference between doing letting go and letting go of doing. Please remember what meditation is. As long as you get involved, you're actually stirring up your mind and it gets worse and worse. Imagine your mind like a lake or like a pond. And to be able to make your mind still, we want to imagine the pond to have no waves on the surface at all. Because only when the body of water is absolutely smooth will it reflect the moon, the sun, the stars perfectly without any distortion. It's just like the still mind can see things as they truly are. But somehow we have to make sure that that lake is perfectly still with no waves on the surface. And how can we do that? This simile, the lake stands for your mind. The waves stand for all those thoughts which run through your mind. How can we smooth out that mind so there's no thoughts in there at all? What many people do with that lake, going back to the lake, they try and pat down the waves. They try and smooth out the water. And all they manage to do is to make more waves. In your mind, when you're meditating, too often we try and get rid of things and control things and make peace happen. That's why the thoughts keep on continuing again and again and again. Instead, we can leave things alone. Ajahn Chah, my teacher, always used to say, the only reason a leaf on a tree moves up and down is because of the wind. If you took away the wind, the leaf would not move. He said, the only reason the mind isn't still is because you're blowing on it. You're wanting and not wanting. That is causing the mind to be restless. I hope I'm making the point here. This is not doing something, it is letting go. It's allowing the mind to be still. You know, sometimes people get their first experience in meditation just when they have a great tragedy, when they're in big trouble, when basically there is so much trouble and suffering in their life, they just get their backs against the wall, they have no other choice but to let go. Sometimes people experience the greatest peace, sometimes in a tragedy, they have to let go. Sometimes people do that when they are very, very sick. A friend of mine who was a monk with me in my early years received a letter from his sister in New York. They were brought up in the Bronx in New York. And one evening his sister, having finished work, did a very stupid thing. She decided to do her laundry in a public laundromat late at night. She was in there by herself doing her washing when a black man came in, took out a gun and told her to take off her skirt. She was about to be raped at gunpoint in New York. This was not a game. Everything her mother told her not to do, go out such late at night, being in a place alone, she had done. The next thing she did was also stupid, but in hindsight it saved her life. She made a run for it. Two bullets hit her in the back. Fortunately, she made it to a doorway, banged on the door, and for great fortune, because this doesn't usually happen in New York, someone opened that door. So the third bullet missed her. She was very badly wounded, managed to call an ambulance and take her to hospital, and she pulled through. She survived. The doctors and nurses were quite surprised that she survived. They asked her what had she done. She'd learned from her brother how to meditate, how to let go, how to relax, because that's the only thing she could do with two bullets in her back and so much blood coming out. That saved her life. She could do that because she had to. Very often people have their first experience of real peace, of letting go, when they're in such traumatic situations. But it shows you what you can do if you know how to push those right buttons, what we call the letting go buttons. Another story which might illustrate this, how letting go means letting go of the past and the future, just being here with what you've got. You've got enough already, so let go and just enjoy what you have. This story was about an old monk many, many years ago who was wandering from place to place, and he came across this poor family who lived in a mud hut. And this poor family gave him a meal, and they were so kind, the old monk decided to stay there for a time. So they built him a monk's hut a little way away, where he could meditate and find some peace. And at the same time, the poor family would feed him. It does not cost much to look after a monk. You know, when our first monks went to England, people were concerned, how much does it cost to look after a monk? And somebody did a calculation, and what they discovered is, it's much cheaper to look after a monk than it is to look after a dog. And there's actually some similarities. You know, we both live in small huts. Now, we call them cooties, dogs call them kennels. We both eat out of a small bowl, and we both wag our tails whenever we see you. We're both nice and kind and cuddly. Now, many dogs are brown like me, too. So they looked after this poor monk, and the monk would teach a little bit of Dhamma and help them with their problems. He was such a nice person to have close to the family. They got quite attached to that monk after a few weeks, and they wanted him to stay there forever. But the monk, after a few weeks, said, "You've looked after me so well. I've taught you a lot. Now it's time for me to go." "Oh, please, Reverend, don't go," said the whole family. And even the children started crying, because they loved that monk like a grandfather. But the monk said, "I have to go. But before I go, I want to reward you for your kindness. Out of compassion, I see you are so poor, but closer than you think, there is a great treasure which is buried in the ground. So much treasure that once you find it, you'll be comfortable for the rest of your life, you and your family." "Here's how to find the treasure," said the monk, and everyone started listening intently. In the morning, stand at the threshold of your hut. Face the rising sun and take your bow and arrow. Facing the rising sun at dawn, let the arrow fly, and where the arrow falls, you will find a great treasure. And the poor man thought, old monks like this don't lie. So he thought, he's going to be a rich man. And as the monk left, he was sad that the monk was leaving, but he was so excited that tomorrow he was going to be rich. So he hardly slept all night. And in the morning he was waiting and waiting, with his bow and arrow, standing at the threshold of his hut, facing the rising sun. And as soon as the sun rose, he shot the arrow in the direction of the rising sun, and he ran after it, and together with his wife, they started digging and digging and digging. What do you think they found? Nothing. Only trouble. Because where they dug, it was a field which belonged to a rich man. And he said, "What are you doing? Destroy my field, you vandals. I'm going to sue you." And the poor man said, "Don't sue me, I have nothing. I only did this because a monk told me to do it." "What do you mean a monk told you?" said the rich man. And the poor man told the whole story. And the rich man thought, old monks don't lie. "You must have got it wrong." "I know what you've got wrong," said the rich man. "How does a poor man know how to shoot an arrow from a bow?" "Look," said the rich man, "tomorrow I will shoot that arrow, and when we find the treasure, we'll split it 50-50. "Deal?" "Done," said the poor man. So the following morning, the rich man, the poor man and his family were standing at the doorway of this poor hut, and as soon as the sun rose, the rich man took the bow and arrow, and he shot the arrow a much greater distance than the poor man, because poor men are thin, they've got no strength. And they all rushed after the arrow, and the rich man told the poor man, "Dig the hole." The poor man told his wife to dig. You know what men are like. And the poor lady dug the hole. And what did they think they found? Nothing. Only trouble. Because that field where the arrow fell belonged to the general in the army. And the general saw them spoiling his field, and together with his soldiers he arrested them all. What are you doing? Destroy my field, you vagabonds. And the rich man said to the poor man, it's his fault. And the poor man said, it was the monk's fault. And the general said, what do you mean the monk's fault? And they told the whole story. And the general said, old monks don't lie. So you must have got the instructions wrong. And when he heard the instructions, of course, it's obvious. What does a poor man or a rich man know about shooting an arrow? This is soldier's business. Listen, said the general, tomorrow we'll all go there and I will shoot the arrow. I will spit it three ways. Okay? Done. So the following morning, the three of them were there. The general, the rich man, the poor man and his family. And this time the general was waiting to face the rising sun. And as soon as the sun rose, he shot the arrow. And it went a long distance. And this time, right in the direction of the rising sun. He was a soldier, an expert in archery. And they all ran after it. The general told the rich man, dig the hole. The rich man told the poor man, dig the hole. The poor man told his poor wife to dig the hole. And she dug. And what do you think she found? Nothing. Only trouble. Because this time the arrow landed in the king's garden. Now it was big trouble because the king had all of them arrested, even his general. And said, what did you do that for? And the general said, it was the rich man's fault. What did you do? Said the king to the rich man. The rich man said, it was the poor man's fault. And the poor man said, it was the monk's fault. And when the king heard the story, he thought, old monks don't lie. So he said, there's something strange here. So he put them all in prison for a few days, while he sent his soldiers looking and searching for that old monk. When they found that monk, they dragged him to the palace. And the king himself interviewed him. He said, explain yourself, monk. Why have you got these three people into big trouble? And the monk said, only because, your majesty, they did not follow the instructions. Just like when I tell you how to meditate. The only reason you don't get peaceful is because you don't follow the instructions. What do you mean, said the king? Okay, said the monk. Tomorrow we'll all go there, and your highness, you can shoot the arrow this time, but following my instructions, and I'll be there to tell you those instructions, and you can spit it four ways. So they all agreed, because the king wanted to find out what was the mistake. What had they done wrong? And the following morning, the four were waiting there, and the king had the simple bow and arrow. And the old monk repeated the instructions. Stand at the threshold of the hut. And the king positioned himself at the threshold. Face the rising sun with the bow and arrow. And he faced the rising sun with the bow and arrow. When the sun comes up, and the sun was just coming up, let the arrow fly. And the king put the arrow in the bow, was just about to shoot it when the monk said, stop. I never said shoot the arrow. I said, let it fly. And so he dropped the arrow. And the arrow dropped right between his feet where he was standing. And the king didn't need to be told afterwards. He just told one of his guards to dig a hole. And he didn't need to dig very far, because right under the threshold was a huge treasure. Enough to make a king happy, let alone a poor man and his family, very, very wealthy. And the moral of that story was not just finding gold or silver or money. The moral of that story is when we shoot the arrow of our aspiration, of our goals, of our desires, we always shoot it over there to somewhere else. And we never realize we're standing on the greatest treasure of all, called peace. So, whenever you try to meditate, remember, don't shoot the arrow anywhere else than where you're standing. Don't try and aim for anything more than what you already have. Don't try and give up what you have now for something else. The goal of meditation is making peace, embracing this moment. And a strange thing happens when you embrace this moment, accept it and make peace with it. You find that what you thought was not still, not peaceful, not good enough, actually changes to be so peaceful and so nice and so free. The last story, which also encapsulates this, and how to be peaceful and how to be free just by letting go, is an old story from my experiences in Western Australia. When I first moved to Western Australia, after I'd been a monk for 9 years, and after helping build a monastery for the first couple of years where I live now, I also received an invitation to actually to teach in a prison. I actually received a telephone call from the prisoner, and he began the call by saying, "You don't know how long it's taken me to make this call. I've had to write so many submissions to the governor and then to the people in the prisons department in Perth just to get permission to make this phone call. I want to invite you to teach us some meditation." And I checked up, and it was a very difficult call for him to make. When I realized that how much effort he'd gone to just to get to me, it was the least I could do to go and serve. And so I started teaching meditation in prison. For those of you who don't know this side story, when I first went to this place to teach meditation, it was a top security jail where some very bad prisoners were locked up. And in this particular jail they had, I think, about 110 prisoners. And when I went into the room assigned for the meditation class, there's about 96 or 97 prisoners sitting down waiting to learn meditation. Imagine that, about a 90% response rate. When I saw how many prisoners had come to better themselves, to learn some meditation, to become kinder people, I thought, wow, these guys really want to learn. And so I was so inspired that I started really doing my best to teach the finest meditation. But after I'd been talking for about 5 minutes, one of the prisoners stood up and asked, "Can I ask a question?" I looked at that prisoner. He was big and looked very mean, with tattoos on him, you know the type. When anyone that big and mean interrupts you, you always say yes. "Well, what do you want?" And he said, "Is it really true that through meditation you can learn to fly through the air, to levitate?" And then I suddenly realized why so many prisoners had come to learn meditation. You can't make up stories like that. That happened. They had all come to learn meditation so they could escape over the walls. So when I told them that only very gifted meditators can levitate, and it usually takes them 10, 20, 30 years, the next time I went there, only 3 turned up for my meditation class. But I like teaching in prison. And I got some of the best questions from prisoners. They had nothing to lose. And later on, when I became an abbot and became a teacher and had to travel around, I had to give that role, that duty, to another monk. He took it on for me. And on this occasion, he'd been teaching in a new jail built in Perth. And having taught prisoners for a few weeks, the one afternoon the prisoners said, "Do you mind staying on a bit longer? We have got some tea and some refreshments for you. We wanted just to chat because we like you, want to find out what it's like being a monk." So he stayed on for an extra half an hour, and they talked about many things because they were friendly to this monk, they liked him. And then they started asking, "What's it like being a Buddhist monk? What do you do?" And so the monk started telling them our routine in our monastery in Perth. He said, "You have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning." And as soon as the prisoners heard that, they were astonished, they were surprised. So even in prison you don't have to get up that early. What time do you have to get up if you're a prisoner in Malaysia? 6? Certainly it's not 4 o'clock anyway. So what do you do at 4 o'clock then? Can you sort of watch the midnight movie? Or watch TV? He said, "No, because in forest monasteries you don't have TV, you've got to meditate." "Well, I suppose that's what a monk does. But then you can have some breakfast." "A lot of time in my monastery there is no breakfast." "What, they don't even give you a breakfast? So what do you do in the morning then?" "In our monastery we have to work. We labour, and sometimes all monks we have to work hard. Recently I was helping building a hut, and I was helping mixing the concrete. Now even a senior monk, I get dirty mixing concrete too, because on this occasion, if ever you mix concrete, it splashes all over you and you get grey spots on your robes and grey spots on your head. It's just a cement, that's all. So we just finished the concrete pour and I was on the way to my hut when I passed a Sri Lankan lady who came to visit my monastery. And she was very well dressed. And because it was the first time visiting my monastery, she came up and asked, 'Where's the abbot? I want to see the abbot.' Thinking quickly, I said, 'If you go up to that hall, he'll be there in about 10 minutes. And she went up to the hall, I quickly had a shower and changed into some clean robes, and then I went to see her. And we talked about meditation, about Buddhism, and she was very impressed that just before she left, she said, 'You have a wonderful monastery and you're such a good teacher. I really like this monastery and I praise it, but if you don't mind me saying, there's one thing I don't like. On the way here I saw a very shabbily dressed monk.'" I never told her it was me. All I said was, "I'll talk to him later, madam." So I get dirty too. We have to work very hard. And the prisoners, certainly in Australia, they don't have to work half as hard as our monks work. And I said, "Oh, they'd never get us to work that hard, but I suppose you have a good lunch. In our monastery we eat out of a bowl, not out of a plate. And in my monastery, sometimes everything goes into that bowl at once. The sweets as well as the main course. And I have many times had my ice cream on top of the curry. Sometimes you get Western food like spaghetti and it's covered with custard." And when he told the prisoners how we eat, they said, "That's disgusting. Even in prison they give you a tray with separate compartments." So they're okay, well, it all gets mixed up inside anyway. But then what do you do after lunch? Can you sort of play soccer or have a game of tennis? They said, "No, monks, we can't play sport." Actually, that sometimes I thought of starting a Buddhist soccer team. But if it really was a Buddhist soccer team, say Chempaka Buddhist Lodge soccer team, how would you play? If you were really a Buddhist,
If the opposite team really wanted the ball, you say, give it to them, here you are, you take it, let him go. Compassion. If they couldn't score a goal themselves, you score one for them. You know, loving kindness, you want to make them happy. So a Buddhist soccer team would not do very well. So no, we don't play soccer or sport as much. What do you do then? Meditate. Oh my goodness, don't you do too much meditation? No, we like it. But I suppose you can hang out for dinner. Dinner, said the monk, the last meal is about 11 o'clock and the rest of the day we don't have anything to eat. What? They said? In all prisons you get 3 meals a day. That's disgusting. Even in Guantanamo Bay you get 3 meals, but not in my monastery. But then what do you do after dinner? Can you actually play cards? You know, play Monopoly or Scrabble? No, it's more meditation. Oh my goodness. And then we go to sleep maybe about 10 o'clock, maybe 11. We sleep on the floor. On the floor? Don't they even give you a bed? I sleep on the floor. And when the prisoners heard how austere and ascetic my monastery was, they felt so sorry for that monk, because he was their friend. They didn't want their friend to live in such a hard environment. And one of them forgot where they were, because they said to that monk, that must be terrible, awful, living in that monastery. Why don't you come in here and stay with us instead? There was a time the monk was invited to go to prison for a more comfortable life. And when I heard that story, it made me think that it's very true. My lifestyle is much harder than a prisoner in any jail. I work harder, I eat less, I don't have any entertainments. It's harder. But why is it that in a monastery such as mine in Western Australia we have 20 monks and there's usually a waiting list of people trying to join, while in prison there's a waiting list of people trying to get out? What is the difference between a prison and freedom? It became very clear to me, a prison is any place you don't want to be. Any place. If you don't want to be here this evening, then Champaka Buddhist Lodge is Champaka Buddhist prison for you. If you're in a marriage you're not happy with, your marriage is like a prison. If you're in a job you hate, going to the office is like going to jail. Or if your body is very sick and old and you hate it, your body feels like a prison for you. Any place you don't want to be is called prison. It doesn't matter how comfortable it is or how hard it is. That's not the point. Any place you don't want to be is prison. And how do you escape from the prisons of life? You don't need to change your husband. You don't need to swap your wife. You don't need to change your job. You don't even need to heal your body. You just need to change your attitude, instead of not wanting to be here, to want to be here. And as soon as you want to be here, you find the key for freedom. I'm not saying you should always just let go, but if you want to know the trick of meditation, it's wanting to be here no matter where this is. Wanting to be in this moment no matter what you're experiencing. When you want to be here and nowhere else, it's called letting go of desire. It's called freedom.
And you can do that at any time in your life. And as soon as you want to be here for many moments in a row, you find freedom and peace. This is called meditation. You've let go of craving, of wanting, of agitation, of negativity. You want to be here. Please understand that that's the meditation method, the heart of it. All the other techniques, whether it's watching the breath or counting or doing this and doing that, it's always trying to encourage you to be here, to want to be here, to be content to be in this moment. Because with that contentment, with wanting to be here, with opening the door of your heart to this moment, as it is, with no conditions, to say to this moment, I love you for what you are, moment, no matter how you feel, you give unconditional love to this moment. That's wanting to be here. That's what meditation really is. Not trying to get to some deep state, that's wanting to get somewhere else. Not trying to achieve enlightenment, that's just going way off into dreamland. But just being here in this moment, accepting this moment, wanting to be here, learning contentment in this moment, and you find the mind just becomes so peaceful and still all by itself. And you learn what the Buddha learnt, how to be still is letting go of the craving. Just for the time you're meditating. I'm not saying you shouldn't crave when you're at work. You have to crave to get up in the morning to go to work. You have to crave to actually to start the car and get to work. But there are times in the day when you stop. You stop and take a rest on the journey of your life. Instead of always trying to get somewhere else, you're content to be where you are. Grateful for how much progress you've made. Grateful for the beautiful people around you, for your wife, your husband, your kids and your parents and your friends. Not wanting to change them, but being content with who they are and where you are. Wanting to be here leads to freedom. And freedom leads to peace. And peace leads to stillness and enlightenment itself. Learn to be free by wanting to be here. You will find that this husband, wife of yours, this life of yours, your children, your parents, your friends, even your business, is not as bad as you think it is. When you learn meditation, you learn how to appreciate things, to value, to love, to be free. So that's what meditation is, in a nutshell. Wanting to be here. I want to be here, wherever that happens to be, and that's why I always feel free. Thank you so much. Okay, now comes the best time for questions and comments and complaints. For those of you who need encouragement to have questions, every time I come to Malaysia I tell this Buddhist story from the scriptures. This is in the Mahakamawibhanga Sutra, in the Majjhima Nikaya, the word of the Buddha himself. Because on this occasion the Buddha started talking about karma and reincarnation. In particular, someone asked him, what is the cause, the reason, why some people are born into rich families while others have to work so hard? Even though they work hard, they're still poor. What karma did you do in your last life to be born like you are? In this scripture, the Buddha also said, what karma you did in the past to be born ugly in this life? And why some people are born beautiful. Whenever I tell this part of the story, I always look at the floor, never at somebody, because once, I think it was in Singapore, I told this story,
And I was looking at a girl when I just mentioned the word ugly, and she complained, "Why did you say ugly when you're looking at me, Ajahn Brahm?" But more importantly, you've got to be very careful as a monk. More importantly, the Buddha explained, what is the cause for intelligence in the next life? Why some people are born clever and they just breeze through school, they go to university, they get top grades. Why are some people intelligent and some people are born stupid? And the Buddha said, the reason why you will be stupid in your next life is if you don't ask questions in this life. That's a cause for stupidity in your next existence. Having said that, does anyone want to ask a question? That's true, that's in the suttas, that's the cause for intelligence. So anyone who has the guts to ask a question now, you'll find in the next life that your homework will be easy. And you won't get into such trouble with your parents. Yes? Are you going to get a... You're talking about letting go.
Our breath is also the watching of the breath is also stopped.
You're asking about the type of meditation called breath meditation, and how are you supposed to do breath meditation? You're supposed to try and watch the breath, or you're supposed to just let go and let the breath happen? You will find when you begin meditation, sometimes it's good just to do a bit of breath meditation to make it happen. It's like climbing a ladder. When you climb a ladder, you have to hold on to the rung above you to pull yourself up. And after a while, you're standing on top of that rung, and that's the time to let go of that rung. You don't let go of the wrong things. Letting go is stage by stage, because one of my disciples in Perth, he went to a reception, a party. But at the party, someone offered him a glass of beer. And he said, "Look, I'm a Buddhist, I don't drink alcohol." And the man said, "Oh yeah, I know about Buddhism, I've heard about it, it's all about letting go. Come on, let go and have a glass of beer." And of course, that's letting go of the wrong thing. So you will find in your meditation that you have to put a little bit of effort in the beginning. You're grabbing onto one rung, but when you get to a certain stage, you let go of all effort and allow the meditation just to happen. And be content to be where you are. And the breath will come to you rather than you going to look at the breath. One of my other favorite stories is a story about the donkey and the carrot. If any of you have been to southern Europe, you may know even now that just for the tourists, they can have donkey carts. A donkey cart would be a small cart which was pulled by the donkey, and it was the main form of transport about 40-50 years ago in southern Europe, in Italy, Greece, those sorts of countries. But the trouble was, donkeys are notoriously stubborn. Even if you hit the donkey, it will not move. The only way to get a donkey to pull a cart of people or goods is to tie a stick to the back of the donkey, and the other end of the stick is maybe 2 feet in front of the donkey's head. On the end of the stick you put a string, on the end of the string is a carrot, and the donkey sees a carrot about 2 feet in front of him, and he loves that carrot so much he moves to try and eat that carrot, but whenever he moves the carrot always moves as well.
And so no matter how fast he goes, the carrot is always 2 feet in front of him. And the donkeys are very stubborn, but they're stupid, and so they keep moving towards the carrot. They never get to the carrot, but they pull the cart. And that's how donkeys move. However, it was about 40 or 50 years ago that Buddhism came to southern Europe. And all the donkeys learned how to catch the carrot, and so there are no more donkey carts anymore. So how do Buddhist donkeys know how to catch the carrot? What the Buddhist donkeys do, they run like hell after that carrot, as fast as they've ever gone. And what happens to the carrot? That always goes just as fast in front of the donkey. But the Buddhist donkey knows how to stop, knows how to let go, knows how to stop running. And what happens when the Buddhist donkey stops? The carrot starts going further away. Just like when you meditate, if you let go, the mind is not as peaceful. It starts being more agitated at first. But the Buddhist donkey has faith. Just like I hope you have faith. And you believe what Ajahn Brahm says. Follow instructions, okay? And the Buddhist donkey has faith, because even though the carrot goes further than it's ever been before, the donkey just waits. And the carrot eventually starts coming back towards the donkey. And when the carrot is 2 feet in front of the donkey's mouth, for the first time the carrot's actually coming towards the donkey, and the donkey doesn't have to do anything. It just lets go, becomes still, and doesn't move, and the carrot comes towards the donkey. And all the donkey has to do at the right moment is to think, the door of my mouth is open for the carrot, and the carrot just comes in. Now that's a very good simile of meditation and enlightenment. You've already been running fast enough. When you let go and stop, the carrot of peace, truth, enlightenment will first of all go further away. Wait, because then it will start coming towards you. And you don't have to do anything. Be still, and at the right moment, the carrot of peace, enlightenment, will come to you. That's always been the way, and that's a very accurate simile to how enlightenment happens, and how meditation happens. It's learning how to be still, like a good donkey. I've got some questions on pieces of paper here, the anonymous questions. So here we go. Venerable, can you teach us some basic meditation, something we can practice every day? Okay, what you can practice every day, a very simple meditation technique, is to sit down. You can sit down on a chair if you like. Many people become enlightened sitting on chairs. You don't need to sit cross-legged on broken glass. You sit on a chair is fine. And just make yourself comfortable, close your eyes. And then this simile came to me when I was in one of the airports. Because those of you who met me at the airport, even though I'm here for a couple of weeks, saw me with just one little bag, my shoulder bag. No suitcases, no backpacks. Because sometimes I've seen people in the airport, you can't believe how many suitcases they've got. When I ask them, they're only going for 2 days. And every time I come back, so often in Perth Airport, I've only got my bag. They say, where's your luggage? And I say, look, I'm a monk, this is all I have, I don't need very much. And actually they look at me and say, oh, well done, very good. Even they understand what a monk should be like, having few possessions. So, I've seen some people with two heavy suitcases. They've got them off the carousel and they haven't got one of these trolleys. They're trying to carry them through the airport. And I remember seeing one person with two really fat suitcases and they were struggling and they were in so much discomfort. And it reminded me of a person when they start to meditate. When you meditate, imagine that you, just imagine you're holding two suitcases, one in your left hand, one in your right hand. And the suitcase in your left hand represents your past, packed full with all of your memories, both good and bad. And the suitcase in your right hand represents your future, all your plans, your fears, everything which you think might happen. The simile is very good because too often we carry around our memories from the past and our fears from the future, and that's what makes our mind tired. Sometimes we have to struggle through the day carrying the burden of the past and the weight of the future. So you start by imagining those two heavy suitcases. With your eyes closed, you almost visualize them as if you can feel their weight. And once you visualize and can feel the weight of those two heavy suitcases, you imagine yourself lowering the suitcase in your left hand to the floor. And when it meets the floor, the weight, the burden disappears. And then you move your hand away from the handle. And then you feel the weight of the suitcase in your right hand. And you lower that to the ground too. And when it meets the ground, the weight is gone. And you can move your hand away. And you feel so light and so free, you're not carrying those two suitcases. And by doing that mental exercise, you'll find that it helps you let go of all of the past, represented by the suitcase in your left hand, and all of your future, represented by the suitcase in the other hand. You've let go by doing a little mental exercise. So try that exercise any time if you're stuck in a traffic light or stuck in a jam, or any time when you've got a few moments. Imagine those two suitcases and lowering each one to the ground. Also remembering the one in the left hand stands for the past, the one in the right hand stands for the future. It helps you let go of the past and future, so you can just be in this present moment, just being here. And with more repeating that exercise, you'll find it so much easier to let go of the past and the future and just to be able to be present and realize the great treasure between your feet, between the past and the future, the great treasure of now. So that's a little exercise you can do at any time. Being present, being mindful, being peaceful. So hopefully that trick will help you enormously. Please guide us to meditate in the right way. I have been guiding you all the last hour and a quarter. Have you been asleep, not paying attention, oh you naughty person? You know you're meditating in the right way if it makes you peaceful and you feel calm and you feel happy. For those of you who want to check me out on this, because you should always ask question and challenge, any one of you who wants to look in the Dhamma Chaitya Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, it's usually translated as the Monuments to the Dhamma. There, one of the Buddha's chief lay disciples, King Pasenadi, who was the ruler in the town of Sarvati. And many of you, if you ever go on pilgrimage to India, will go to the famous Jeta Grove Monastery, the Jetavana, which is right next to the town of Sarvati. And this was where the Buddha spent most of his time when he was alive, in that monastery. And one day the king went to see the Buddha. And when he went into the Buddha's hut, the first thing he did after paying respect to the Buddha was to say how much he enjoyed coming to this monastery, Jetagrove Monastery. And the Buddha said, "Why, great king, do you enjoy coming here?" And the king replied, "Because whenever I come into this monastery, the monks are always smiling and happy." That's what disciples of the Buddha used to be like in the time of the Buddha, smiling and happy, not grumpy and miserable. There are too many grumpy and miserable monks around these days. You know, it's a great shame that the chief priest passed away, because he wasn't a grumpy monk, he was always happy and smiling. And the Buddha replied, "Yes, great king, that's what you can expect when the monks meditate and understand the Dhamma. It makes you happier. So you can understand what meditation is. If it's the right way, it's the smiley way. So if the meditation makes people smile and become happier and peaceful, then they're going in the right direction. If it makes you miserable, angry, stuck up, a pain in the backside, then you don't know what meditation is." So that's how to meditate the right way. If enlightenment is the ultimate happiness, there's extreme happiness, Nibbanam Paramam Sukham. And if meditation is supposed to take you there, it should lead to greater and greater peace and happiness. That's why I like my master Ajahn Chah. He was the happiest person I ever knew. So I thought, if he's that happy, he must know something. And he did. Another question, or a deep question here. Does a stream winner know when he or she has attained this stage of the does a stream winner know when they have attained that stage of their attainment? Yes, they do. If you become, have insight, of course you know you have insight. If you win the lottery, you soon find out, don't you? You keep checking your tickets, and this is much better than the lottery. So certainly a person who sees the Dhamma knows they have seen the Dhamma. And actually that's one test. Because as a monk, sometimes people say, "Oh, they become enlightened, they're the stream winner, they're an arahat," or whatever. And sometimes you have to test them out. You know, one of the tests is saying, when and where did it happen? And if you don't know the exact moment and time, you fail the test. Question 2. Any study stories about benefits of a pregnant mother meditating for the unborn? Any pregnant women attaining jhanas? But certainly, as many pregnant women in Perth who've learned meditation. And it's amazing, time and time again, when the baby is born, it's a very peaceful, calm baby. They don't wake you up in the middle of the night. They're wonderful babies to be around. They're just so still, because any person, any doctor knows that for the first months inside your womb, you know, your consciousness is the baby's consciousness. What mother does, the baby does. And if the mother learns how to be peaceful and calm, so does the baby learn how to be peaceful and calm. So it's a wonderful thing for the mother to do, because then you can get back some sleep after the baby's born. You get a very, very nice baby. But you know, one of the weirdest stories which somebody told me, and this is really like make your hair stand on end, because just after the baby was born, you know, the mother usually puts the baby on the chest so they can breastfeed the baby. And the mother was laying in bed with the baby on top of her, and the baby sat up, put its legs in the lotus position, and meditated. she really got spooked out there, because the baby had only been born like a couple of days and just crossed its leg, put its hands in its lap and assumed the meditation position. That was a weird experience. But people tell me these strange experiences, and I thank them because it's more material for my talks. But if you teach a baby how to meditate by meditating yourself when you're pregnant, oh, they're wonderful kids. So good thing to do. You're nurturing and teaching your child by example. One of the other things you can do is listening to Dhamma talks when you're pregnant. This one disciple, her husband had a job in Saudi Arabia, and you know, in Saudi Arabia women can't do any work. I think she was a qualified accountant, a very clever girl, but there's no way she could get work, so she took a whole lot of CDs of my talks with her to Saudi Arabia just to pass the time. So when she was pregnant, she listened to about 4 or 5 hours of my talks every day. And she gave birth in Saudi Arabia to a nice little girl. And on her first visit back to Perth, she came to see me with her new baby. And the baby was, you know, just in her arms, just not paying any attention. But as soon as I started to talk, the baby looked at me. They recognized my voice. Oh, it's him. So the babies, they do pick up on what you're doing when you're pregnant. So enormous benefits. When meditating, thoughts keep coming to my mind of the past and the future. Do I linger and dwell in them, letting them be, or do I note them and let them go? Oh, don't even note them. Just make peace with them. Don't try and force them out. If you try and force them out, you're giving them energy and they will get worse. Just let them go. You just be like a passenger. You know, sometimes it's like getting on the aircraft to come from Australia to KL. Some people, they rush to the front of the aircraft thinking they're going to get here quicker. Once you're on the aircraft, you don't have to do anything. You just sit down and rest and relax. Just like when you meditate, you sit down, you don't have to do anything, all you need to do is to enjoy, not the in-flight service, to enjoy the insight service supplied in every meditation. So that's the best way. Don't linger and dwell on them, and don't try and get rid of them. Just allow them to be and allow them to disappear. Don't feed them. Please tell us what is the most important thing you learned from Ajahn Chah. Okay, this is a deep teaching. And many great things I learned from Ajahn Chah, but I've only been talking about this just about the last year or so, because there's many teachings, and you know, one comes to the front of your mind and it stays there for a while. In the first year I was with Ajahn Chah, this was over 32 years ago, he'd used the following simile. He said his monastery was like a mango orchard, and the mango trees, he said, had been planted by the Buddha a long time ago. He said all the mango trees were mature and they were all dripping with mango fruits, ripe and delicious. He said because the Buddha had planted those mango trees and they were full of fruits, these days you monks don't need to do anything. All you need to do is to hold out your hand and a mango will fall. That's what Ajahn Chah would teach. I thought he was crazy. What do you mean? If you want a mango to fall, you've got to climb the tree, at least shake it, or usually, you know, you throw a stick up or whatever. He said, no, all you need to do is put out your hand and the mango will fall. After 2 years I understand what he meant. If you shake the meditation tree and try and make it happen, mangoes never fall. You just get more frustrated and you think you can't meditate. All you need to do is to put out your hand and peace falls into it. Insight falls. Enlightenment falls. When you just pull your hand out and let go. Don't make it happen. Allow it to happen. And that's a very deep teaching of Ajahn Chah, but it's so precise. If you understand that, you understand everything about meditation and enlightenment too. Why every time I meditate I feel sleepy? Answer, because you're tired. When you're sleepy, make peace with your sleepiness. When I started as a monk in Thailand, I was very sleepy. And I tried hard to stop being sleepy. One of the things I did was to put a matchbox on top of my head with a cover off. Because with a matchbox on top of my head, if I started getting sleepy, my head would tilt down, the matchbox would fall off, and I would know I was nodding. So that would actually give me some feedback to make sure I wasn't sleepy. And sure enough, after a few days, I could put the matchbox up on top of my head, even getting up really early in the morning, 3 o'clock, and meditating, 3 a.m. Put the matchbox on my head, it never fell off. I thought, great, I've conquered my sleepiness. But I hadn't. A monk took me aside and said, I've been watching how you meditate now. When you meditate, you used to nod like this. Now, he said, you nod like this. I was so disappointed. That didn't work. So instead I tried all my effort to try and break through. Come on! And I willed and struggled and strived until I conquered my sleepiness. But as soon as my sleepiness disappeared, I started thinking about everything. My mind was just so restless. So I tried to calm my restless mind. Come on, calm, calm, calm. And then I fell asleep again. And to me it was like a pendulum. Either I was restless or I was asleep, and I couldn't find that middle. Now I know why. The reason I was sleepy is because I was getting up at 3 a.m., going to bed maybe 11. Number one, I was not sleeping enough. I was an English man living in the jungle. We were malnourished, our food supply was not enough, and it was hot. What do you expect? It was just nature, that's all. And what I learned was to make peace with my sleepiness. I let it be. I just noticed it as best as I could, but I did not make war with my sleepiness. I made peace with my sleepiness. And what happened was the sleepiness soon disappeared. Naturally, my energy just came back. But when my sleepiness did disappear, it wasn't restlessness now, it was peace. Because I'd made peace with my sleepiness, when the sleepiness disappeared, I was left with peace. Don't make war with your sloth and torpor, make peace. It will soon disappear, and what you've made is what you're left with. Peace, not war. I read that during meditation I was supposed to still my mind to get one pointless, but I found that my mind wanders and thoughts keep surfacing. So does that mean I'm not letting go? How do I get that concentration? Don't call it concentration, call it stillness. How do you become still? By not moving. What does moving mean? Trying to get rid of things. Not being content, not wanting to be here. You want to be somewhere else. You make prison.
If you want to be here, it's called loving kindness, metta meditation. It's making peace, not war. What you experience now is called the result of old karma. It has a cause, and this is the result, what you experience now. If you want to have good meditation in the future, if you want to have peace and hear what you call concentration or stillness, you can't get stillness by making agitation. All you can do, whatever you're experiencing now, make peace with it, be kind to it, have compassion towards this moment, allow it to be, and then you're making the karmic causes for peaceful meditation in the future. If you're making peace now, you'll have peace in the future. If you make war now, you have collateral damage, as Mr. Bush says. You have dead people, wounded people, a lot of ruins in your mind. So that's actually how we meditate, by doing good karma in this moment to our mind. Being kind, embracing, forgiving, making peace, not war, with this mind of yours now. That's a very powerful deep teaching. If you understand that, you get into very deep meditation. So you don't still the mind, you make peace with the mind, and then stillness comes. How often to meditate and how long should each session last? The rule of thumb is, how long do you eat? Meditate as long as you spend time eating every day. Why is it we can always find time to eat? Because it's important for us. We get sick if we don't eat. It's the same for meditating. If you don't meditate, meditation is called food for the heart, and if you don't meditate, you get sick in the head. You know what being sick means? You get angry, and you shout, and you're critical, and you're grumpy, and you're depressed. That's called being sick in the head. Now there's a story about this man who had the afternoon off work, and his wife was busy cooking the dinner, and she looked in her kitchen and she was short of some eggs. So she asked her husband, "Darling, I need some eggs and I'm so busy, but you have the afternoon off work. Can you please go to the market and buy me some eggs?" He said, "Certainly, darling, I can do that, but you have to tell me where the market is and where the store is. I've never been there before." So she gave him the basket and money and directions to the market, and off he went. As soon as he entered the market, this young man came right up to him and said, "You've got a face like a camel. You're so ugly, the backside of a camel that is, and you smell of dog shit." "What do you mean talking to me like that?" said the husband. "I don't even know you." And that was only the start. He started to scold and abuse his husband so badly and in front of everybody. And the husband didn't deserve that. He didn't even know that young man. And being scolded in public embarrassed him so much he turned around and went home. As soon as he got in the door in home, his wife said, "Have you got the eggs, darling?" He said, "No. And don't ever send me to that stupid market ever again. People are so uncivilized and so mean." He was upset. And those of you who are married know how to deal with a husband who's upset. You've got to sort of stroke him and be kind and soft until he settles down and gets some sense out of the fellow. And only when he settled down could she ask him, "What happened?" And he told the story, and the wife said, "Oh, it's him. That poor boy is brain damaged. When he was small, he had an accident and hit his head. And ever since that time, he damaged his brain. He always does this.
The poor boy will never go to school, nor will he ever find a girl and get married. He can't get a job. He's crazy because he hit his head and damaged his brain. He always stays in the market. Sometimes he scolds me, sometimes he swears at somebody else. But we don't mind because the man is mad. He's crazy. He's brain damaged. He's insane. As soon as the husband realized he was being shouted out by a crazy person, it didn't matter anymore. And as soon as the wife saw that her husband didn't mind, she told him, "Darling, I still need those eggs." He said, "Okay, I'll go back. And don't mind that crazy boy. No, I won't mind now, but I know he's mad." And so he went back to that market, and the boy came up to him again and said, "Hey, here comes camel face. Hold your noses, here comes dog shit." And this time it didn't matter, because the man, the husband, knew the poor boy was mad. When he went to the egg store, the lady selling the eggs said, "Don't mind him. The poor boy hit his head when he was young. Yeah, I just found out he's brain damaged. What a shame." And even though he was being abused, it didn't matter, because being abused by a crazy guy. The moral of that story is, if you're being scolded by your husband, just think of it like that boy. Your husband must have brain damage. He must have hit his head on the way home from work. If your wife scolds you, it's the same. She must have hit her head. It's called temporary insanity. But don't take it personally. So that's actually how to deal with abuse. And you can only do that if you train in meditation. It's food for the heart. You become wise. So meditate as long as you eat every day. Why are some people born beautiful or ugly? It's a beautiful reason. It's because people are kind and generous. They're good-hearted. That's why they become beautiful. Even in this life, kind-hearted people are very beautiful. Doesn't matter how old they are. People love to be around them. They love to see them because they've got an inner beauty. So it's one's virtue makes one's beautiful. And I mentioned that many times in Perth. When I said I'm going to give you the five precepts here, I said I'm going to give you beauty treatment. And a monastery or a temple is beauty parlor. This is Chempaka beauty parlor. Makes you more beautiful. And the reason for ugliness is anger. Ugly people are people who got angry so often their mouth got stuck in that position. And they're like monsters. No one likes to look at them. They're that ugly. So the more time you get angry, the more ugly you get. And no amount of Botox will solve that problem of anger. You get uglier and uglier and uglier. Buddhists usually adopt the middle path. They usually do not take side in any political issues. They usually do not come out and vote during election day. Voting is all citizens' duty. So are the Buddhists doing the right by being indifferent to politics? It's a great question, because we discussed that at our fourth global conference. What's Buddhist role in politics? But in politics, we're not so supporting any political party, but as Buddhists, we are stakeholders in society, and we should address any problems which we have in society. And usually, the Buddhists, we can still vote, but we're not troublemakers, because we don't demand to get our own way. But we want to make a positive contribution. And Buddhists have always made such positive contributions in whatever society they have been in. And one of the things, there are many Buddhist politicians, not last night, the night before, at the Buddhist Fellowship's gala dinner, I was sitting next to the health minister, Mr. Khaw Boon Wan, who's a very devout Buddhist. And Because he is a Buddhist, the senior member of the government of Singapore, Mr. Khaw Boon Wan, in his portfolio of health services, I was told that since he took over that ministry, that he has returned what he called, what they call in Singapore, the Class C wards, which are for the poor people. Because many of the hospitals in Singapore had actually phased out those wards and only kept the Class A and Class B wards for the rich people or the middle class. And many poor people could not afford or could not find space in the hospitals. And that was one of his great things he'd introduced in Singapore. So there was just someone being kind and compassionate. And if you're a Muslim, if you're a Christian, you do the same thing. So can't we as Buddhists actually contribute to our communities and societies by voting, by participating, by making a positive contribution? Especially as a Buddhist and you keep your five precepts and you're not corrupted, you don't get into alcohol and doing sort of bad deals, but you're honest, trustworthy and compassionate. So that's something we can do. We don't go arguing. You know that fellow I mentioned earlier, Dr. Jeff Gallop? He was the Premier of Western Australia for many years. He was actually one of the other ministers. A minister for planning told me this story. I was sitting next to her at a function and she said, this man is a Buddhist, even though he doesn't admit it, because whenever they had an argument in the cabinet, which, you know, politicians often argue, this man, Dr. Gallup, would bang his fist on the table and said, be quiet, we should be more Buddhist about this. That's what he would say, we should be more Buddhist about it. In other words, the contribution of Buddhism would be to listen to each other, to be kind, compassionate, not angry at each other. So we do have something to give, so we should give it. How can we meditate while we are doing our everyday chores? Some Chan masters say we should meditate while doing everyday chores. How? Be content to be here. So in other words, when you're washing up, don't try and get rid of the washing up so you can have your cup of coffee afterwards. Want to be doing the washing up. When you're doing the vacuuming, want to be here. When you're in the traffic jam, want to be there instead of getting angry and upset at all those other stupid cars. There are many times when you can meditate by learning how to accept the present reality of now. That is the essence of meditation. When you sit down, what you learn in everyday life will actually propel you into deeper meditation on the cushion or on the chair. And the last question, I can't see any clocks here, so I don't know what the time is. Venerable Sir, in the Dhammapada stories, many attain sainthood by listening to one discourse by the Buddha, even the killer who was about to kill the Buddha. Why was it so easy for them to attain sainthood? Would we be able to attain sainthood by listening to the Dhamma? Oh my goodness, how many of you here have listened to talk after talk after talk after talk? These days you can have iPods full of Dhamma talks by the best teachers all over the world. My talks are on the internet and even people in Iceland listen to my Dhamma talks. You have so many talks you listen to, but how many of you are enlightened? Come on, own up, how many? So why is it that we can listen to so many talks but we never get enlightened? It's the same reason why you can go and read so many menus in so many different restaurants but you're still hungry. You know why? Because you read the menu and then you eat the menu and you never order the food and eat that. That's what the talks are there for. They're teaching you something you're supposed to do. The menu gives you the choice of what's on, and that restaurant, choose the food and eat it.
So in all different talks you've listened to, the great menu, the buffet of Dhamma teachings, choose some and use some. If you just listen, you're just like the person who ate menus. You get very, very sick. By the person who just read all the books but never understood what they meant. So the reason in the time of the Buddha that sometimes a person heard a talk and became enlightened was because it wasn't just that one talk they heard. That was just the last moment of their journey. In the same way, I've been to many people's houses, and on the shelf I see photographs of theirs or their children's graduation at university. Have you ever been to a graduation ceremony where a person gets a degree? All that's recorded, all you see in the photograph, is someone dressing up like a penguin with a funny hat and going up to some dignitary and giving a scroll of paper. So if you just see that, you think that's all you need to do to get a degree. Just wear a funny costume and go into the convocation hall and someone give you a degree. Because you never take photographs of all the lectures you went to. You never take photographs of all the tutorials you had to attend. You never take photographs of the examinations. The only photograph you take is of the final moment when you get your degree. In the same way, in many of the suttas, they just take the last moment where the person just made that final breakthrough to become enlightened. But in each one of those cases, you find, if you look deeper, all of those men and women who became enlightened by just that one discourse, that was just the last act of a long journey, which included keeping your precepts and meditating and studying and discussing. And that was the last thing which just turned them into being the saint. But don't think that was the only thing. So that's why you can listen to a Dhamma discourse, even listen to the greatest teaching of all, and still not get enlightened, because you're not ready yet. You haven't had the preparation. So this is the preparation. You know, it's strange how some people became enlightened, even like Ananda, the disciple of the Buddha, his main attendant. You all know how he became enlightened? Just after the Buddha passed away, that Venerable Mahakasapa decided that to keep the teachings pure and the precepts pure, to have a conference, a convocation of all the great monks so they could record the teachings for posterity. And so they chose 500 senior monks to come and record the teachings. 499 of those were fully enlightened. Ananda was the 500th, the odd one out. Imagine that. All you people on a retreat, if the last day, the 80 people on this retreat, if I said 79 of you are now fully enlightened and you're the only one who's not, how would you feel? That's sort of how Ananda felt. So that night, he decided to give it everything he got. He would not sleep. He had to get enlightened. And so, he meditated all night. And he got nowhere. And so at the very end, he gave up. And according to the legend, after giving up, just before his head hit the pillow, he became fully enlightened with all the psychic powers. And to prove the point, he went to the convocation late and he entered through the keyhole of the door. That was pretty awesome. To enter the room through the keyhole using psychic powers. But the point of that story, he became enlightened by letting go and by going to bed. And that's a wonderful piece of advice to end this first talk. You can all now go to bed and try the Ananda method of enlightenment. Who knows, just before your head hits the pillow, you too may become an arahat. But if you do, tomorrow morning at 5 o'clock, or whenever we get in here, please enter the meditation hall upstairs through the keyhole. It'll be a cool thing to see. So thank you for coming this evening, and thank you for all those questions. The first talk of this series on meditation. What's the talk tomorrow night? So I was going to give the advertisement for coming up soon in a theatre on a temple near you. The next talk tomorrow night will be on mindfulness. So the power of being awake and alert. And that helps you in your marriage, in your health, in your business. So this is only the start of Ajahn Brahm's Wealth Creation Seminar at Champaka tomorrow night. So thank you for coming. Do we do sharing of merits in the end? Okay, do sharing of merits. Please chant with me. Idam me nyatinam hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me nyatinam hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam me nyatinam hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good, the three happy sadhus. So when you do sadhu here, don't just go sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Sadhu,
sadhu.
The three happy sadhus. So thanks very much, good night. And those who are meditating, have a nice night's sleep. See you in the morning. If you're gonna clap, clap properly. Come on. Okay, goodbye.